I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the London Book Fair and a very special edition of the Read Like a Writer podcast. The first one we've ever done live and the first one we've done with as many wonderful guests as well. It's faintly odd to be sitting here surrounded by the huge cavernous space of Olympia, but also in this lovely faux fur-covered chair with a headset on. Feels somewhat like a cross between Britney Spears and Sansa Stark. With me, also dancing like Britney, although maybe we'll save that for the parties later, we have Jess Kidd, who's the author of himself, The Hoarder, and the wonderfully titled Things in Jars, which is published on April 4th. Then we have Claire McGlasson, who works as a journalist for ITV News Anglia, and her debut, The Rapture, is out very shortly this year as well. Finally, but not least, we have Alex Nathan, who's written many books for both adults and children, including The Last Fire in 2014 and The Flight of Sarah Battle the following year. And this July, we can look forward to her upcoming book, The Warlow Experiment. So I wanted to ask all of you, and at first it was actually quite fortunate because you sat in alphabetical order, which I'd written down to be fair, but now I think I'll take you in chronological order of the order that your books are set in as well, because you were all writers of historical fiction set in different periods, at least for the ones you've got coming out at the moment. So Alex, your book is set in the late 1700s, isn't it? I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about the Warlow experiment.
Well, it's set in it goes from 1793 to 1800, just that small gap. And I happened to read an extraordinary piece in an annual register, which I have a numerous annual registers. And I read a piece about a man who had lived underground for 7 years. He'd been invited to do so by somebody. But he had to live underground and he had to have no contact whatsoever with anybody. But however, he wasn't living in severe conditions. He had wonderful conditions. Beautiful food was sent down every day and he had everything he could want, books and anything you might want if you were on your own living underground for 7 years.
And this, of course, is what forms the basis of your novel, isn't it? The idea that someone would voluntarily participate in this experiment to live solitarily underground for 7 years.
And the puzzle was, why, first of all, why would anybody agree to do it? And what happened to him? And also, why did anybody set this up in the first place? I mean, what on earth was that all about? So I had to sort of get into that.
Which I think it does quite easily as well. And I think there's this lovely spirit of rationalism that starts with and then it completely decays as it goes all the way through into something kind of much more monstrous almost.
Yes.
In a very large sense of the word.
Yes, I'm a bit worried. I've just started reading Frankenstein for the second time, having read the wonderful Fiona Sampson's book on Mary Shelley. And I'm worried by the fact that, you know, that is a book about a monster. And I hope my characters haven't become monstrous, and I hope I haven't been propelled by that book. But yes, it does. The whole situation becomes pretty terrible.
And Jess as well, so moving on to you. Now, you're set in the Victorian era, and in a slightly more magical realist way, there is actually a more sort of extra human person in yours. But can you tell us a bit about Things in Jars?
Certainly. Well, Things in Jars is set in London in 1863, and it follows Bridie Devine, who is an investigator of the bazaar, and her latest case is the kidnapping of Christabel Berwick, who is a child who is said to be remarkable and also a child who's said not to exist. And so, you know, Christabel is a curiosity, and there is a potential that she could become a spectacle. And London of that time loved a spectacle. So Bridie fights to recover the stolen child, and this makes her enter a world of fanatical anatomists and crooked showmen as well. And so as she's trying to find Christabel, the ghosts of her own past are sort of resurrected through her search.
So I think it's interesting because both you and Alex have the core of almost science perverted along the way in both of your books as a theme. But then, Claire, you opted for looking at things through the lens of religion in the 1920s.
Yes.
So can you tell us a bit about yours?
Well, The Rapture is based on a real cult of women in Bedford in the 1920s. It began in the 1920s. They were called the Panacea Society, and they believed their leader, Octavia, was the daughter of God and that they lived in the Garden of Eden.
Which was a detail I loved, by the way, the idea that the original Garden of Eden would be in suburban Bedford.
Suburban Bedford's very nice, but yes.
I'm not knocking it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they had lost husbands, sons, brothers in the First World War, came to believe that men had made rather a mess of things and that salvation was assured through Jesus, but they needed women to bring salvation on earth. So based on a real group of women, and the title speaks of the rapture of religious fervour, but also of falling in love.
It's interesting that you mentioned, actually, because there was a particular quote from your book that I thought was quite fascinating, and it's obviously, it's set just after the First World War. It says, "The war stole their brothers, their husbands, and they were left with great piles of money in their place. They inherited freedom." Now, I think for all historical writers, and yours does it very explicitly, but there's a lot about, you kind of have to wrestle with the role of women in that particular time as well. Now, Claire, your characters have sort of set up a largely majority female society, haven't they? And there's this idea that there are more women and fewer men at that particular point in time by sheer demographics. But there's still a sort of sense that they probably don't have as much freedom as they want. Do you think that's true?
I think they're a strange group in that, on the one hand, they were very radical. You know, it's a feminist interpretation of the Bible, which was, you know, very much out there. But in other ways, you know, they were very much a product of their time. So they're still restrained and restricted by wider society, and they put themselves in this environment where they're spying on each other, they have to report on each other of their sins, so it's a very claustrophobic world that they've put themselves into.
And then, of course, Jess as well, your central character, Bridie, she of the terrible bonnet, which, poor woman, she gets mentioned ever such a lot.
Oh, the bonnet. Yeah, it's a very important aspect of Bridie Devine, yeah.
But she's also very tough. You know, she can handle herself. She's very intelligent. She's made her way in a world that really isn't set up for independent women to make their way in.
That was the difficulty, actually, coming to write it, because I knew I wanted to write a female protagonist, and I also wanted it to be access all areas. I wanted her to go into every sort of realm of society, from the rookeries of London to the country drawing room. And I realised that actually it would have been very difficult for her to get access to a lot of the places, things like operating theatres, she wouldn't have been able to necessarily go into. And so she assumes a number of disguises and also creates a fictional dead husband to allow herself to present as a widow, which allows her to move more freely.
It gives her that veneer of respectability, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So there's lots of different layers to Bridie, really, that she can draw on.
And then, of course, Alex, for you as well, although, you know, there are protagonists of many different genders in your novel, but I was thinking particularly about Catherine the Maid, who's an incredibly smart woman and is frustrated by her station in life. You know, she can read and write a fair hand, as it's put at the time.
Yes, I mean, it's very... I was worried by the fact that my two main protagonists are men, and you know, I'm not doing what I should be doing, just writing about women.
I don't think there's any need to, really.
Well, it kind of did worry me somewhat. But Catherine is somebody who sort of comes gradually forward through the book. She's not even present at the very beginning of the book. But it would, I mean, life was very difficult for women in the 1790s, unless you were highborn and had a lot of money, like Duchess of Devonshire. You couldn't do much. She's very restricted by her position in life.
And there's also Hannah as well.
And Hannah, of course, is a victim.
She really doesn't have the benefit of Catherine's intelligence or the limited education that Catherine has had.
Absolutely. And she is a very, very unfortunate victim. But, I mean, given the situation, in a sense, it perhaps there had to be a victim.
Yeah, I think several people are probably victims along the way in different respects.
Yes, well, you could say so, yes.
As a more general point, and any of you can answer this one first, but I wonder, you know, how much of our own time do you end up putting into historical writing? How much can you never not be a writer of the late 2010s while you're writing about a different era?
I think that's a really good question, and I'm a cross-genre writer anyway, so I'm always drawn to hybridity and the kind of clashing of different elements, and that's one of the fascinations. I think you are necessarily mediating that experience through a lens of your contemporary time, which sets up this kind of debate between the time, your time, and then potentially the future times when someone will approach your book in the future. So I suppose what you're looking for is to set up a resonance between the times and pick out elements that you want to discuss in the here and now, but use that time accordingly.
I can see some nodding there, Claire.
I think historical fiction, or the best kind, holds up a mirror to ourselves. You know, we look at the past and we take from it what we will. Something like Barbara Kingsolver's latest novel, you know, speaks very much to our time. But I do love the escapism of the historical setting and I like the research element as well.
I don't really think about my own time when writing this, but what I'm hoping is more in a way what you were saying, Claire, which is that I hope that I'm addressing fundamental human problems and human relationships. And I think, you know, historical fiction can do that as well as any can, if it's any good. I mean, one has to get one's period right, of course, that's perfectly true. But that's not all it is. And sometimes when people have come and said to me, oh, I learnt so much about the period from your book, and I think, oh, no, you know, that's awful. I'm not a historian. I don't want to teach people about the period. That's not the point.
It's the setting for the larger human drama, which should be...
It should be.
Timeless.
It should be. Mm.
This is a terribly cheesy segue. Speaking of timeless, we're going on to your favourite bookshops, some of which are new, some of which have been there for a while. Claire, I wondered if you could kick off. Now, like your book, your chosen independent bookshop is also in Bedford.
Not far from the Garden of Eden, in fact. It's a few streets along.
I mean, how often can you claim that
exactly.
As a retailer?
So Rogan's Books in Bedford, which is run by the wonderful Rachel Rogan, who got into bookselling quite by accident, was sort of persuaded by people she'd set up book groups for children and babies, and the suggestion was made that she start a bookshop, which she's done, a children's bookshop where everything's curated, everything's hand-picked and hand-sold. So she wanted to create a shop where any child could go in and see themselves somewhere on one of the books on the shelves. And I'm pleased to say she's now opening a big new adult section. So it's now a children's and feminist bookshop. So there'll be space for adults to go and browse while the children are in there. But she's so passionate. She's learning as she goes along, and lots of community events. And I love the fact that she has read and loved every book in there.
I mean, that's quite something for recommendations, isn't it? Speaking of books you've read, you said that Margaret Atwood, several of her books, were quite an influence on your current novel as well, On the Rapture.
Yeah.
Can you explain a bit why that is?
Well, Cat's Eye is a book I studied for A-level, and is the reason I went on to read English at university, because I loved it. And there's a lot of power politics in that amongst children. It's fantastic. You know, the manipulation, the control between the young girls in the book. The Handmaid's Tale is a book that I've loved for many years, and I'm delighted that, you know, more people have come to it now thanks to the TV series. But there's obviously the faith element of that, and how belief and faith in something can manipulate your view of the world to such a degree, and how gradually that can happen. So Handmaid's Tale was a huge influence. And also Alias Grace, which I love in terms of that claustrophobic, you know, the historical setting, and also the unreliable narrator.
Mm. That's very interesting. I can see that.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And then, you know, you're obviously, like so many of us, I imagine, very keen to read Atwood's sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, The Testaments. But you're also very much looking forward to Eleanor Anstruther's A Perfect Explanation, which I hadn't heard of before you mentioned it, but sounds fascinating. It's loosely based on her grandmother's life, isn't it?
So it's a tale of an aristocratic family of which she is a member. I think it's her father who's key in the book. And it's a tale of how a child within that family was sold. And I think I've read a little bit that she said with her father's wishes, she delved back into the story that he never spoke about. You know, he never wanted to talk about it, but with his blessing, she's drawn that story from him. And I've heard wonderful things. I think it's published in the next... Could be tomorrow, actually.
Yes, it's out in March. Right, okay. So, yeah, mid-March. I think it is this Thursday. And then... In terms of a book you surprised you love, you've actually mentioned a few titles, but it's more of a genre that people are surprised by and that you have surprised yourself by getting into.
Well, crime is not something I've ever really read. I don't tend to watch crime dramas. I don't necessarily have that, you know, competitive streak of wanting to know who done it. The mystery doesn't appeal, but why they've done it, it does. And a friend of mine, Elodie Harper, wrote a story called The Binding Song and another one called The Death Knock. And, of course, I read them because she's a friend of mine. And what I loved is that she tackles the things that make me feel uncomfortable about crime or maybe my assumptions about crime, you know, violence against women, things I find difficult to read. She tackles that head on and actually, you know, goes against it and explores some of the stereotypes, I suppose. So I found her approach really refreshing, and I think crime is a wonderful tag to sell books. You know, any genre can be good because it makes people reach for a book, but it also, I think, can put people off sometimes. I think that I'm much more open-minded to crime than I was.
I think that's all of us being open-minded about putting things in genres. Probably a very useful lesson for the whole fair. Alex, before we sort of sat down in front of our wonderful faux fire here, you and I were both talking about Shropshire, which is where your favourite bookshop is in Bishop's Castle, isn't it?
Yes, we live 3 miles outside Bishop's Castle. It's a very small town, 2,000 people living there, I would say. Not very well equipped for shops at all, but it has a shop called Art and Artisan, and it sells art books and craft books. And also, you can buy the most fantastic socks there, which have been knitted in every single colour you can think of. And unfortunately, I'm not actually wearing any today. I should have worn some today. Anyway, but it's a lovely shop, and they will get books for you. I mean, even though I can't afford the art books that I really would like to get there. So one's just so glad that there is a shop there at all. And actually, I did read in the big issue the other day that apparently... last year, 15 new independent bookshops were established in the country. And I thought that was just marvellous. And one has established itself in another town called Montgomery, which is 6 miles away from where we live. That's actually in Wales. But, you know, hooray.
This is Eves and
Lord. That's wonderful.
isn't it? Eves and Lord in Montgomery is the one you...
Yes, that's right.
Have you had a chance to go in yet?
Yes, I have, and I've already bought a couple of books. But I haven't told them that I'm mentioning them today. So I have to go back and...
Well, it's always any excuse to go back, hey?
Absolutely.
And looking at some of the other things you said as well before, so you've talked a lot about Penelope Fitzgerald.
Oh, yes.
You said, which is very humble of you, I wish I could write like her.
Oh my goodness, absolutely.
But you say that also Fitzgerald's work has really influenced yours as well.
Well, I mean, she just is somebody I would aspire to be like. Her books haven't influenced what I've written because my writing's not as good as hers is. But, I mean, she has this absolutely marvellous style, which is very economical, which one can aim for. And which I also know that her books are historical fiction of various sorts. And that also, if you read the biography of her, that she did the most enormous amount of research for each of the books that she wrote. But you'd never know it. The research is used so lightly that it's as if she hasn't done any.
Which very much ties in, actually, to your earlier point about not letting the history get away in the way of the story.
Absolutely.
I can see why you're a fan in that respect.
Yes, yes,
And then a really interesting one, actually, is that you think people will be surprised that you really love William Gibson. You've picked out Virtual Light as one of his books in particular, but Gibson, in general.
Science fiction is something that I've hardly read any of in my life. But recently there have been some William Gibsons at home and I've picked them up and thought, well, I'll give it a go. And absolutely marvellous stuff. And I just think that there could be an interesting similarity between science fiction and historical fiction in that this is a creation of a whole world. Of an exotic kind, which perhaps most people don't know about. And, of course, with the science fiction, it involves amazing research, and one has to... I mean, I can't say that I've really understood all the ideas that there are in William Gibson. But it's a whole world which seems quite different, but actually is all about human beings. So it gets back to the point we're making forward. It's really actually is all about human relationships and so forth. And he's very funny.
Yes,
hilarious.
I don't think people give him enough credit for that, actually. People
perhaps
always
not.
Talk about him as being a very, you know, future-facing thinker, someone who can create all of these different worlds, who can coin sort of terms that then come into popular usage.
Mm.
But yes, no one really gives him any credit for being quite amusing as well.
Yes, it made me laugh a lot.
Finally, one of the things you said you were most keen to read coming up would be the final volume of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall
trilogy. Oh, well, yes. I mean, we're all waiting for that.
Well, I mean, who isn't? But
who isn't, Tiny? Oh, well, just, I mean, Hilary Mantel was very kind to me in the early days of my writing. I mean, I've never met her, but she just was, I mean, apart from anything else, it's that that I was very, very grateful for. And so, of course, I'm very curious. I mean, we've waited, haven't we? We've waited for longer than we were expecting. So,
what is it you liked about the previous two books in the trilogy?
Well, I suppose her historical writing is totally different from mine. I mean, she does enormous amounts of research. One has to do research. But she dares to write about people who everybody knows and who other people have written about and historians are bothered about. Whereas I've chosen people who nobody knows. So, you know, I feel I can get away with murder, really.
But but who are nonetheless...
And she can't.
No, I suppose there's a certain element that her plot's already been predetermined for her and she has to fill in around that. I was actually going to mention that she'd been incredibly full of praise for your writing as well, which I think is something that probably most authors would dream of, really.
Well, that was lovely of her, yeah, it was very nice.
And
wonderful.
I think obviously quite worthy as well. And then, Jess, moving on to you. You're a big fan of The Open Book, which is in Richmond in Surrey, aren't you?
I am. It's a great place. It's kind of a TARDIS of a place and you keep going further and further back into the shop. And it's run by Helena and staffed by Maddie and Kirsten. And it's got quite an interesting history, as well as some really loyal customers who make comments. Like, one customer in particular thinks it might be haunted by Elizabeth I, who died just around the corner in Richmond Palace. So there's that kind of idea to it. And they also recently came up with the idea, because I think Virginia Woolf's going to get a statue in Richmond, so that, you know, when it was a hardware shop, she was like a regular customer, that kind of thing. So it's a great place, and it's a place where you go and there's stories spun around it. And so I love going there.
There's a book that you say people might be surprised that you love, and it's actually one of the classics, so I was wondering why people think it's a surprise. It's Madame Bovary.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's not a surprise that anyone would love the book, because it's an absolutely beautiful, tragic novel. But I suppose the reason why I picked it is because it's so different to the kind of work that I do. Flaubert made this incredible story of a rural doctor's wife, And Emma tries to part from her sort of life of mundane reality by flights of fancies and some affairs, and it all ends terribly, as it would in a tragedy. But what I'm really drawn to is the kind of humanity in the novel, and the way that realism works in the novel to sort of build up this kind of detailed portrait of a life. And so, I mean, I also use realism to kind of try and root the reader in an everyday world, but I stretch it a bit by bringing magic realism to play as well. And so I also love the kind of way that Flaubert has this kind of sort of reticent narrator who's not willing to make judgments, and so we feel real empathy and sympathy for Emma accordingly. So again, I struggle. This is something I struggle with my narrators. They always like to put their oar in, and so I think I come from more of a kind of storytelling tradition in this respect. That you know, that my narrators are sort of quite present, really. There, so yeah, that's why I picked it. I feel like it's a perfect novel, really.
It's a great recommendation. It's interesting as well that you talk about this idea of hooking the magic realism onto some realism, and also a narrator sort of being very invested in a narrator as well, because this makes complete sense when we talk about the book that's influenced your writing as well. And you mention Perfume.
Perfume, Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. I love this book. I mean, it's a strange and twisted plot of a protagonist who's born in the 18th century France. He's left for dead in a fish market in Paris, and he grows up to have no personal scent of his own, but this kind of supernaturally gifted sense of smell. And so he navigates by scent. And so what Susskind was doing was onto this kind of real detailed aspect of his training to be a perfumer and the world itself. He was sort of grafting this supernatural element on. So I found this completely fascinating, and also in the way that the character can move around sort of unnoticed and things. So I thought, okay, that's really interesting, because I wanted Bridie to be able to do the same, to assume disguises, although she's not as twisted, obviously, as the individual in Perfume.
I think we can safely say that Bridie's probably more on the side of the good.
I think she's more on the, well, there's a twinkle in her eye, but I think yeah, she definitely is.
On the whole, any good character is completely black or white.
Yes.
And talking of other things that you've recently read, you've mentioned The Bus on Thursday by Shirley Barrett, which was out in hardback last October, and the paperback is coming out later this year.
Yeah.
What is it particularly about The Bus on Thursday that's appealed to you?
It was an incredible book, actually. It follows Eleanor, who's just got a teaching post in rural Australia, and she's replacing a teacher that everybody loves. It's Mrs. Barker has disappeared. Miss Barker has disappeared, and so people can't talk about her without crying. And so Eleanor sort of already is set up for failure. But she's also reeling from a recent treatment for breast cancer. So it explores her relationship with an ex-partner and her family and so forth. And so as the book sort of continues, it becomes very absurdist and sort of unravels. And it's just very, very wicked and very, very funny and very, very odd. And so all the things I quite like in a read, really.
At this point, you are looking quite wicked and quite funny, but I'm not going to say odd, okay, because that would be really mean.
That would be mean. Yeah.
And also not true, okay, Jess.
Thank you.
That's been brilliant. Thank you, all three of you, for talking a bit about your own books. I can call you the future of historical fiction as well, perhaps. But thank you for joining me and Read Like a Writer for the London Book Fair special edition.
Read Like a Writer was brought to you by Faber & Faber, Serpent's Tale, Profile Books and Canongate, and was presented by me, Anna Fielding. And we'd love to hear what you have to say too, so do tweet us at readlikeapod.
Pod. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.